Now I think my article in the newsletter must only have confused you. You either have to do it wholeheartedly or not do it. I knew that was a risky piece when I wrote it. I would like to express my gratitude to Christine Park, who read the scriptures but whose name was not in the bulletin. We have at least two unique gifts as Homo sapiens. We can recreate the past by a faculty called memory. We talked about it last week. We can also project ourselves and all our longings into the future. We can hope. We don't do it because it's virtuous. We do it because we can't help ourselves. Because we literally cannot live without hope. It may be as fragile as a piece of cotton thread. It may be 99% illusion sometimes, but we have to have it. This fall, we begin to operate a state lottery in Kansas. I had intended to say this before I read the morning paper, but if you have not read the first page of the morning paper, you need to read the article about the lottery. We've heard the pros and cons until we are surfeited with them. The new money will help us get better schools, reduce taxes, fix roads, or poor people will risk money they can't afford, become compulsive gamblers, be manipulated by organized crime. Some truth probably in all of it. But one thing is certain beyond dispute. People like lotteries when they like them because lotteries offer hope. Wild, irrational hope. Hope against any kind of sensible odds. One chance in 20 million, maybe. Professional gamblers, I'm told, laugh contemptuously at lotteries, but still hope. An end to the unpaid bills. An end to dull drudgery in a job you don't like. A chance to do all the things you've ever dreamed of doing. A French philosopher once watched a beggar spend his last few cents on a lottery ticket, and he asked the man how in the world he could commit such a folly. The answer may have been unassailable. In order to have something to hope for. Somebody listed the grand essentials to happiness in this life as something to do, something to love, and something to hope for. Whether we approve of it or not, when people lose the first two, they'll hunt hope anywhere they think they can find it. Hopeless people do not write, because writing is an exercise in hope. But others have written about the absolute necessity of hope ever since written versions of our human drama began. Around the time of Christ, a Roman philosopher, statesman, known as Pliny the Elder, called hope the pillar that holds up the world, the dream of a waking man. Somebody else sang its praises like this: there is no medicine like hope, no incentive so great, and no tonic so powerful as the expectation of something tomorrow. So it's no surprise to hear the biblical proverb, Hope deferred, hope delayed, makes the heart sick. We don't like to have to wait, at least not a long time. But even hope deferred is better than hope destroyed. Because when that happens, when there is really nothing left to hope for, life is over. Hope is as essential as a heartbeat. Dante's Inferno, the most terrible picture of hell ever drawn, has that famous warning over its entrance. You remember it from school? All hope abandon, ye who enter here. To be left with no hope at all may be as good a definition of hell as we can come up with. Can you think of a more desolate word in human relationships than this one? It's hopeless. So people cling desperately to hope when they've lost everything else, and even when it seems insane to expect a decent tomorrow. I suppose, having lived so deeply in the Jewish scripture, I think inevitably of how they were sustained by hope. The Jewish people, against incredible odds, they kept going to bed at night, believing that tomorrow would be better. Here's a typical example. They had a bad experience once in a valley called Achor. The word even means trouble. A bad time in that valley, while they were trying to make their way out of the Sinai desert and into Canaan, the promised land. You'd think they might have wanted to forget Achor, Valley of Trouble, but they remembered it on purpose as a way of convincing themselves that they should never give up. And so instead of recalling only a desolate place where a bad thing happened, their prophets turned it into a symbol of hope. One of them, Hosea, represents God as saying, I will make the valley of Achor into a door of hope, meaning that the worst thing in the world can be a prelude to hope, to something better. Can be. Another prophet, Isaiah, spoke of that same disaster, where for all we know the cattle may have died for lack of grass and the people for lack of water. And he said that in the mercy of God, the valley of Achor would become a place for herds to lie down in, beside clear water in lush green pasture. I don't think he meant that literally. I don't think he was hoping for a reclamation of the desert, complete with irrigation wells. He was simply trying to say that in company with God, the most dismal memory can be transformed into a symbol of hope. If you wish to shout back at me that he didn't know what he was talking about, that you've tried and tried and found no hint of a response to your hoping, I would be at a loss for comfort except to say that a promise like Isaiah's goes beyond good sense and depends at last on a kind of wild trust that transcends logic. Some of you know what I mean. So what both these prophets knew, without learning it in psychology class or in seminary, was that there has to be something to look forward to, even if logic is wounded. Will Durant, the historian of ideas, put it as bluntly as it can be put: man cannot live without hope. Which is why, he tells us, from Novgorod to Cadiz, from Jerusalem to the Hebrides, there are steeples and spires raising themselves precariously into the sky, symbols of hope. That's what they represented to our forefathers in New England, those tall white spires that pierced the sky from every little village. And we chose, in planning our own church, to perpetuate that symbolism. It would have been more practical to have left off the steeple. We expect to arrive in Wichita this week, but we wanted a symbol of our hopes reaching up, and so we gave up something else in order to have it. Everything, Martin Luther said, that is done in this world is done through hope. We learn that at home quickly. A child on Christmas Eve or on the day before her birthday lives for the presents she'll open the next day. And in that sense, we all live like children. There are so many presents still to be opened tomorrow, next month, next year, and the looking forward keeps us going. The hope doesn't have to be very impressive. It has importance out of all proportion to its size. When I was a child and found out that light traveled at 186,000 miles per second, I went out for a while at night and shone a flashlight, it wasn't a very big flashlight, up into the night sky, and then I sat there and thought about the amazing journey into space that I had just started. I smile at it now, that feeble little battery light launched on a lonely trip through the universe, but I have found it analogous to the way we use our hopes. We flash them out into the surrounding dark. We make a little aureole of light around us. And in that light, frail as it may be, we live. We cannot live otherwise. Even when we are disappointed, as we often are. I heard of some people once who thought that at Christmas it would be fun at the community party to wrap an empty box for the village's retarded boy to open, to see his eagerness and watch his face when the tinsel and the ribbons were off at last, clumsily, and he opened the lid and there was nothing. They weren't very bright or sensitive people, so they did that. And I've thought ever since I heard about it that it serves very well as an image of what life does to us sometimes. Not so deliberately, not with malice, but does anyway. And what we had hoped for does not come. We open the box and nothing is there. The new friendship that promises so much and gives nothing. The child that seems to mock all the years of love's investment. The marriage that never fulfilled its promise. The church that gave hope of helping to fill our emptiness but didn't. We drop the wrapping paper on the floor and turn away with a forced smile, betrayed. But we have a strange and wonderful resiliency. Hope springs eternal in the human breast. And so we forget the trick and we hope again, because we have to, or die. We have no other choice. I saw that at first hand several years ago when I watched what can happen to a perfectly healthy human being when deep depression sets in, and depression is the absence of hope. A doctor confirmed what I had thought, that my mother was in a state of profound depression, a long, exhausting struggle to keep her only daughter alive had ended in a funeral. She was physically worn out, psychologically drained. She was utterly without hope that tomorrow could be worth living. It took a while and a little help from the pharmacy, but I could tell when she began to get better, because hope came back. She began to look forward to things. Simple things, but enough to nourish hope and make life possible again. Dressing up to go to the senior citizens' lunch program, discovering she could still outwalk a friend as old as she was. Looking forward to summer when she would see a grandchild named April, a name, by the way, which is a cousin to hope, a word for springtime. And all these things may not sound like much to build a life on, but they were. They meant hope, and hope made my mother's life possible again. I struggled last week with this sermon because I didn't want it to sound facile, to sound like a thoughtless Pollyanna approach to life. In a lifetime of teaching literature, and that includes the Bible, I think I have read and accepted an enormous amount of cynical and pessimistic reflection. I understand how easy it would be for someone in this audience to stand up and shout, "You're not realistic. The odds are all against hope." I'm sure they are. Damon Runyon, who loved to write about colorful gamblers, said once that life is 6-5 against. And I think I'd say at least that much. But we never pay attention to the odds for very long. I saw a film years ago, very forgettable for the most part, called Harry and Tonto. And Harry in that film certainly knew the odds, but he also knew that life means hoping. And after all his disappointments, at the end of the picture, he was kneeling beside a child on a beach to help her build sandcastles. An image of life going on, of dreams and play, of unquenchable hope. I have my own images. My friend, for example, whose alcoholic wife disappointed him over and over by failing, but who somehow never lost his hope. One night she really embarrassed him in front of some old friends, and afterwards, talking about it, she broke into tears. "Why don't you leave me?" Because, he said, "I remember a very beautiful person, and I believe she's still there." A definition of hope, against the odds, but in the faith that those who challenge the odds sometimes win. I'm extremely fond of the books of a scientist named Loren Eisley, an evolutionist who writes like a poet, and who argues that we all share this essential thing called hope because its signature is written on the whole earth and sky and sea. Cells divide, flowers grow, trees put out leaves, animals mate and protect their young, all in a kind of cosmic expectation looking to the future. Hope is natural. Like other natural things, it can be starved or even lost. But like other natural things, most of the time, all one has to do to get it back is to remove the abnormality that blocks it. Sometimes the most helpful thing you can do is hope for no more than just the moment ahead of you. It may be too hard to believe in the next day, so you concentrate on the next moment. You cultivate what the French call charmingly, I think, le petit bonheur, the little happiness, which I think may be the most useful strategy anybody can adopt. To learn to look at the promise of a meal, to a book yet to be read, to a birthday coming up, to the recreation of sleep, to sink the roots of a young and tender hope into soil as simple as that and let it grow. And not to surrender. The first time someone with a loud voice says you are foolish to hope. Pessimists do not have all the truth, though they always act as if they had. There's nothing childish about thinking that tomorrow may yet bring some good thing, and if the odds are against it, then to hell with the odds. That's where they belong.